education, and it is time for America to do better. There is no way that we will ever be able to give our children a healthy and a fair start under any of the terms of the budgets being proposed by the White House or the state houses or the Congress. We need a change in paradigm. We need to say that we're going to have different priorities.
And some are urging Congress to stand for children in other countries as well, like kids who work in sweatshops making clothes that bear the names of celebrities like Kathy Lee Gifford.
En realidad, yo quisiera hablar con Kathy Lee para pedirle que nos ayude a poner fin a todos estos malos tratos.
Really, I'd like to talk with Kathy Lee to ask her to help us to put an end to all this maltreatment so that they'd stop screaming at us and hitting us and that they'd allow us to go to night school and to organize to defend our rights. And we want Kathy Lee to return her work to the factory but with better conditions and a just wage.
A special look at children's issues on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman.
For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are.
This Saturday, thousands of people will gather at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. to participate in an event called Stand for Children. The rally is organized by the Children's Defense Fund and is co-sponsored by 3,700 other organizations. It's being billed as a national day of renewal, celebration, and commitment to our nation's children, where young people, seniors, and Americans from all walks of life will make a commitment to do better for our children, young people, and our families. We now turn to Ruth Seidel. She is a professor at Hunter College here in New York City and author of a new book called Keeping Women and Children Last, America's War on the Poor. Why don't we begin, Dr. Seidel, with you telling us what is the state of America's women and children?
Well, women and children are in a very precarious situation. Among the millions of poor people in this country, women and children make up the overriding majority. 75% of poor people are women, and 40% of poor people in the United States are children. Among children under the age of 18, one out of every five lives in poverty, and among children under the age of six, a shocking one out of every four officially lives below the poverty line.
A quarter of the kids below the age of six lives in poverty in this
exactly,
country?
Exactly. And when I try to teach that to my students and make the numbers mean something for them, I count it out, literally 1, 2, 3, 4 in the classroom so that they can understand how really incredible a number that is.
How has it come to be that a quarter of the kids under the age of six live in poverty?
I think there are many, many reasons. Obviously, one is the cutbacks, which have been ongoing for the last decade or more in this country, actually since Ronald Reagan. Another is the devaluing of the paycheck, of the minimum wage, and of people who even earn above the minimum wage. People are losing money. They are not making the same kind of money they did 20 years ago. Obviously, the increase in single-parent families, because female-headed families are much more likely to live in poverty than dual-parent families. I think that there are many, many reasons.
What are you proposing should be done to diminish the number of people in poverty, maybe even to end poverty in this country? I know that's a revolutionary idea.
Right. Well, I think that we could come close to ending poverty in this country. I think there might always be a few poor people, but we could certainly come a long way. I think we should move in many directions. Obviously, raising the minimum wage is very, very important so that working people, millions of working people who now live in poverty, could be raised above the poverty level if we raise the minimum wage enough. We also ought to have a real safety net for all of our families. Virtually every Western industrialized society already has a universal family policy, which prevents millions of people from falling into poverty in the first place. A universal health care for all of our families, daycare and access to after-school care for the families who need it, perhaps children's allowances, paid parental leave, a whole panoply of services and really guarantees that would prevent many of our families from falling into poverty in the first place.
Are you talking about what the Republicans are calling big government?
Yes, I think I am. I think some of it can be done by private industry. I think private industry could do a great deal more in daycare and maybe even in after-school care and in health care and in many other ways. But I think that as last resort, the government will have to step in. I think they will have to create jobs. If we don't want mothers on welfare, we really want them out in the workforce. Those who wish to go to work, we're going to have to create jobs for these people, jobs that pay above the poverty line. Pushing people off of welfare into jobs that pay below the poverty line gains us, I believe, essentially nothing. In fact, may lose the families a great deal. So the government, I think, will have to step in to create jobs. Government will have to step in to create the kind of safety net that, again, virtually every other Western industrialized society already has. I think that we need government to make our society the kind of humane, caring society we want it to be.
Well, last year, when I was covering the first 100 days of Congress down in Washington, I was hearing endless debates among, I would have to say overwhelmingly white and male Congress members talking about why young women, and we're really talking about girls here, teenagers, have children, and talking about, you know, cutting them off, talking about taking them off of the welfare rolls when they have more children on welfare, because they contended that's why they were having kids, to get rich. What do you think of this whole trend?
There is virtually no evidence that women or girls have babies in order to get welfare. Sure, people, researchers or journalists are going to be able to find the one or two or 10 or 20 cases. But overall, virtually all teen pregnancy is unintended and unplanned. Studies show that 85% of teen pregnancy is unintended. And certainly people are not having children in order to get those, you know, miserly welfare checks. It's not even cost efficient. They can't even take care of their children on those checks. So that I think the thinking is really, you know, fallacious. Over the last 20 years, AFDC benefits have dropped nearly 40%. And the number of single-parent families, particularly women having children outside of wedlock, has grown significantly. So the evidence just isn't there.
What can be done to stem the tide of teenage pregnancy?
I think what we have to do is offer our teenagers real options. We know that in order to postpone childbearing, in order to encourage people even to have fewer children in those countries in which they want to do that, the way to do that is more education, more job opportunities, and raising the standard of living. We know how to do this in countries all over the world. What is incredible is that we don't adapt that knowledge to our own society.
Let's talk about some of those countries. You are an international scholar. I knew your work in college, your work on women and children in China. You've also studied the health and human services system in Britain, in Sweden. What systems do they have from China to Britain to Sweden?
Well, it's hard to combine, you know, third world countries, and China still is a third world country, to Britain and Sweden, etc. But the thing that they have in common is a belief that the society is at some level responsible for the well-being of all of its children. I think that this really is a fundamental premise of many of these countries, and it's out of this fundamental premise that many of their policies come. We are stuck, I believe, in an individualistic mode where we feel that we have to take care of ourselves and that it is evil for our government or the society to help take care of families. I think what we have to understand is that families cannot go it alone in the last part of the 20th century and the 21st century. It is impossible. It's our ideology. It's our American dream, but it doesn't make sense, and that we have got to institute some of the same policies these other countries have in order to help families nurture and care for one another.
You've just returned from the People's Republic of China. While you say you can't compare a third world country as you consider China today in the United States, are there lessons we can learn from China?
Well, China is a very difficult example because, of course, China has some excesses that none of us like, along with some really model programs that many of us like a lot. There is just no question that the daycare provided in China is truly terrific. It's magnificent. It's caring. It's not yet for everybody, but there is many really quite marvelous experiences with daycare in China.
What is it? How is it formed?
Well, it's organized both according to the workplace and within the neighborhood. There are many magnificently talented teachers who really love children. I think the Chinese really love children. Again, I say this against a backdrop of, some accusations against the Chinese about their treatment of female babies and all the rest. So I know it's a tricky thing to say. Healthcare, of course, was also a model, really, for the third world, and some of us thought even for developed nations many years ago. While they're phasing out barefoot doctors and some of the experiments that they used 20 years ago, nonetheless, they've kept some of the local control and the local encouragement of less professional, not completely professionalized healthcare system. I think that above all, again in China, they recognize that we are all responsible for one another's well-being. Even in their rush to get rich and get rich quickly, one only hopes that the Chinese don't lose some of the models that they developed that so impressed many of us many years ago.
We're talking to Professor Ruth Seidel. Her latest book is Keeping Women and Children Last. She's in Washington now, going to be attending tomorrow's Stand for Children rally. What do you think is the most important message that you'd like to see come out of this rally?
I think the fundamental message is that there are millions of Americans out there who really care about the well-being of children and who feel it is a societal responsibility to make sure that in this incredibly affluent, rich society of ours, that there are not 15 million children as there are poor children as there are today, that our infant mortality rate should not be 18th in the world, that our black infant mortality rate should not be double our white infant mortality rate, that we shouldn't have children who are hungry and homeless in this very rich society of ours. I think if we can get through the message that there are millions and millions of Americans who will not accept those conditions in this rich society, we will really, or Marion Wright Edelman and the Children's Defense Fund and all the other organizations that are supporting the march will really have accomplished something.
How do you think, then, the Republicans have garnered as much support as they have? I mean, more than half of the people in this country are women, and many of those women are mothers. Where is the mandate for the kind of revolution that they're putting forward?
I don't think there really is a mandate, and I think that's one of the fallacies that we are suffering from at the moment. I think the 1994 election was not a mandate for the contract on America, as many of us call it. I think it was really rather a mandate for change. I think that people were discouraged. They were disheartened by the politics that they were seeing, and they voted for new people. I don't think that they voted for such policies, particularly against poor children. And I think that when people are polled and asked if they would be willing to have their income tax raised so as to help poor children in this society, overwhelmingly they respond that they would. I think if the issues were put to people fairly and they really understood the statistics, they really understood the genuine conditions under which people lived, that there would not be any such mandate. And I think we're gradually finding that to be the case.
The trends of increasing poverty in this country certainly go back before the Republican domination of Congress. It went through the Democrats as well. What do you think is the legislation that's necessary to help kids in poverty, to help all kids?
I think, again, I would go back and certainly support raising the minimum wage, which would raise millions of working families out of poverty immediately. I also think that we need a complex system of universal guarantees for all of our families, not just for the poor, not just for the rich, but for all of our families. Again, we need universal health care. We're one of two industrialized countries that doesn't have some kind of universal health care system. We need access to daycare, access to after-school care. Again, we should consider children's allowances. We certainly need paid parental leave. Without it, single families and poorer families cannot take parental leave. We need decent housing. We need nutrition for all of our children and mothers. It is possible to do all this. The resources are there. It is cheaper in the long run to prevent people from falling into poverty than to deal with the problems of poverty. We can do it. What we need is the political will.
Have you seen any experiments around this country where people are lifting themselves out of poverty, or communities are working together to end poverty in a specific area?
I don't know that it's possible, really, to do it within an individual community, and I don't know of such experiments or such successes. I do believe that people in the United States are compassionate, and were they to understand the depths of the poverty that many children live in, that would not be acceptable to them. And I think that they are ready for those kinds of experiments rather than the experiments on the state level, the quote experiments on the state level, which are really a form of doing away with the welfare system. I think doing away with welfare is a mistake. Block granting welfare is a mistake. What we need is some way of combining welfare benefits with work options and with guaranteed family policy. And in that way, we can raise families above the poverty line.
We're in a presidential election year, of course. President Clinton, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, is there anything they're saying that makes sense to you?
Not a lot. Unfortunately, I hate to say that, but there is not a lot. I think everyone is pandering to the fear and anxiety of the American people today. I think many Americans are fearful of their own lives. They're fearful of their own jobs, their own health care, their own children's education. And I think that they need someone to blame for the problems that remain unsolved in their own lives. And the poor are just too handy a scapegoat. And if you add race to poverty, you really have a scapegoat that works. And I think both parties are really scapegoating the poor. And this is, after all, what the Stand for Children demonstration is also all about, that we will not permit the poor, particularly poor children, to be scapegoated for the many problems we have in this country.
Well, Dr. Seidel, this is certainly one way to get the message out, this massive rally that is going to take place tomorrow. Are there other suggestions you have for people? Because it is an election year, the politicians have to listen just a bit more. There's a little opening of that window for a few months.
Right. I think there are other options. I think everybody who understands the facts about poverty, rather than the mythology about poverty, has got to speak up. We have got to counter the stereotypes. We've got to counter the scapegoating. And we've got to go out there and reform the question. The question has been articulated, what is wrong with welfare and how do we fix it? I don't think that is the question of our time. I think the question of our time is, the issue of our time is poverty. And the question of our time is, how do we help families to raise themselves out of poverty so that all of our children can have a decent life? We've got to reframe the question and get out there and say it over and over again on those call-in shows and in letters to the editor and our church groups and our community groups and around the coffee table where we work. I want to emphasize that in this election year, all people who are concerned about the well-being of children, and particularly about children in poverty, should ask the candidates who are running for office in their area, what about poor children? What are they going to do about poor children? What are their expectations that welfare reform, quote unquote, which of course is not reform in my mind, will do for children? How will they help to raise the millions of children out of poverty if they're elected to office?
If people want to get information from the Center for Study of Family Policy at Hunter College here in New York City, where can they call?
They can call the sociology department at Hunter, which is 212, of course, 772-5585.
That number again?
772-5585.
And that, of course, the 212 area code. Well, Dr. Ruth Seidel, we want to thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
On this day before the Stand for Children rally that's taking place tomorrow in Washington, D.C. And we want you to stay with us because this whole program is devoted to young people, to children. Coming up, we're going to be hearing from Marion Wright Edelman, who with the Children's Defense Fund is organizing this massive rally tomorrow. We're also going to hear from a young woman, 15 years old, Wendy Diaz, who is in Central America working for Walmart, who is making Kathy Lee line of clothes. She's going to be talking about what it means to be a child in Central America working for a U.S. corporation. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow's Stand for Children rally is being billed as a nonpartisan event because no politicians, no elected officials of either major party have been invited to speak or use the event as an election year photo opportunity. However, the fact of the event has given politicians a chance to make a statement and take a stand on the fate of children in this country. According to statistics from the Children's Defense Fund, the group sponsoring tomorrow's rally, every day in the United States, 3 children die from abuse or neglect, 15 children are killed by firearms, 91 babies die, 1,407 babies are born to teen mothers, 2,660 babies are born into poverty, 2,833 children drop out of school, 6,042 children are arrested, and 8,493 children are reported abused or neglected. On the eve of this children's march, President Clinton took the opportunity to speak out about children, but he used the occasion to bolster his image as tough on crime, clearly a favorite campaign issue. Speaking at a Black Pentecostal convention in New Orleans, Clinton endorsed curfews for children under 17 years old.
It basically says, if you're young, after a certain amount of time, you ought to be home and not on the street where you can get shot or fall in with a bad crowd. Now, you want to know if it works? During the very first year, youth crime dropped by 27% during the curfew hours, armed robberies dropped by a third, auto thefts fell by 42%.
President Clinton citing a Justice Department report on curfew programs in 7 cities. Children's issues are a particular concern to First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, who's been affiliated with the Children's Defense Fund for many years. Here are some excerpts of her reading from her most recent book called It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us.
All of us, whether we acknowledge it or not, are responsible for deciding whether our children are raised in a nation that doesn't just espouse family values, but values families and children. I have spent much of the past 25 years working to improve the lives of children. My work has taught me that they need more of our time, energy, and resources. But no experience brought home the lesson as vividly as becoming a mother myself. When Chelsea Victoria Clinton lay in my arms for the first time, I was overwhelmed by the love and responsibility I felt for her. Despite all the books I had read, all the children I had studied and advocated for, nothing had prepared me for the sheer miracle of her being. Even though our national rhetoric proclaims that children are our most important resource, we squander these precious lives as though they do not matter. Children's issues are seen as soft, the province of soft-hearted people, usually women, at the margins of the larger economic and social problems confronting our country. These issues are not soft. They are hard. The hardest issues we face, they are intimately connected to the very essence of who we are and who we will become. Whether or not you are a parent, what happens to America's children affects your present and your future. Government has to do its part to reverse the crisis affecting our children. And to do so, it cannot retreat from its historic obligations to the poor and vulnerable. Yes, we must work to balance the national budget, but we cannot afford in the long run, or for much longer in the short run, to balance it on the backs of children. They do not deserve to inherit our debts, but neither should they be denied a fair chance at a standard of living that includes health care, good education, a protected environment, safe streets, and economic opportunity.
Hillary Clinton raises the issue that's become a central controversy of tomorrow's march. While over 3,700 advocacy and religious groups around the country have endorsed the event, right-wing groups are not participating. The Family Research Council says the Children's Defense Fund is advocating big government as the answer. The Family Research Council is holding a press conference today. Pacifica was able to obtain an advance copy of the statement to be made by Gary Bauer, the president of the FRC. He says, for the Children's Defense Fund, the organizer of the impressively named Stand for Children rally, the best advocate a child has is a government official or bureaucrat. But government is often part of the problem, both by implementing family-unfriendly policies and diminishing the importance of the people who best love children, parents. Those, again, the words of Gary Bauer. At a press conference yesterday, Marion Wright Edelman echoed the theme of Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village, and emphasized that everyone, government, families, communities, religious institutions, schools, and businesses, all must play a role in improving the lives of children. One reporter asked Edelman why the Children's Defense Fund felt it had to organize a massive demonstration.
Oh, because it's time. It's time. You know, I and many of the people who work together for children and have done so for many decades, have tried everything. We have done our research and will continue to do our research. We've issued our reports on the conditions and needs of children, and we will continue to do so. We have lobbied. We have done our leadership training. But it's not been enough. We need a movement. We have come after many years of incremental progress, you know, two steps forward and send some steps backwards to a 1994 period, when all of our efforts for many years, beginning with President Roosevelt's attempt to build a safety net, were threatened with those who not only did not want to move forward in preparing our children for the 21st century, but who were trying to dismantle the child nutrition and child care and income and health safety nets. And I guess I said to myself, what kind of leaders at a time when 10 million children don't have health care have the temerity to debate a Medicaid block grant that would take health care away from another 3 million children rather than strengthen that health safety net? What kind of people would be trying to talk about welfare reform that would make another million children poor rather than fewer children poor? What kind of people permit its leaders to talk about the sins of abusing and neglecting children, which kills them every 7 hours, and then lets our leaders dismantle a child welfare system? What kind of hypocrisy, how much hypocrisy are we willing to tolerate when our governors and our president go off to an education summit and we talk about, as they ought to talk about, preparing our children for the year 2000 and goals 2000 at the same time, and the Congress, the governors, and others, and the members of the Congress are talking about taking away the health and safety and quality standards for childhood, child care, to get our children ready for school. So there's a disconnect here between our values that we preach and our values that we practice, and it's enough. More importantly, you know, the problems of our children are escalating with the breakdown in family and community, and violence is everywhere, and our children are growing up in a prison of terror. We issued a child gun death report about a month ago that showed not only has the violence against children by guns become routine in our nation, it is increasing, has almost doubled over the last decade. What is it going to take for us to stand up and say that the killing of children in the world's leading military power is wrong and that we will stop it? So it's just enough. Our cup of endurance runneth over with the neglect of our children, from preventable sickness and illness, from guns, from miseducation, and it is time for America to do better. There is no way that we will ever be able to give our children a healthy and a fair start under any of the terms of the budgets being proposed by the White House or the state houses or the Congress. We need a change in paradigm. We need to say that we're going to have different priorities that put our children and families first. And so that's why we're standing, because we're on the cusp of a new millennium, and we will never be able to have a strong America unless we have strong children. It is a statement to every politician of every persuasion that they're not doing enough for all of our children, that we must change in a very fundamental way the priorities, investment priorities of our nation that puts our children first, that this nation can, like every other industrialized nation, give all of its children health care, that this nation can, like every other industrialized nation, keep its children safe from gun violence. So we're saying the children who don't vote and aren't Republicans and Democrats must not be political footballs in an election year and must be left off the budget chopping table. And not that's not enough, because we're tired of reacting to other people's agendas. They must be positively protected, that they must all be ready for school and must be healthy and well fed, and that their chances to succeed should not depend on the chance of the state they were born in or the parent that they were born to.
Do you feel left out by the Clinton administration? Early on in the administration, there were many very positive, the Head Start announcements and the school lunches. Do you feel since then there's been a letdown in focus by them?
Well, we have made much progress, as you say. We have a reauthorized Head Start program. There's a new Family and Medical Leave Act on the books of the president. That was his first signing. We have a family preservation law that was passed after two vetoes by the former president. We have an earned income tax expansion, which has done more to lift people out of poverty than anything that we've had in a long time. But all of those have been threatened. And so we face, again, the dismantlement of both these new victories as well as many of the old hard-earned incremental victories. And we think that the president and the Congress must stand up and say, we will not go backwards, we will go forwards. And so, we must have a movement. We must make it clear that there is a broad-based constituency out here that wants to have one house of justice for all of our children, and not one house for the rich child and one house for the poor child, not one house for corporations in the Pentagon and another house for poor working and middle-class families. And so that is why we're taking this step to build a movement to say we want positive policies that retain what we have, but more importantly, move ahead to prepare our children the way in which is required.
Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund, sponsor of tomorrow's Stand for Children rally at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Edelman says tomorrow's march is not a one-day-only event, but it's the beginning of a movement.
And on June 2nd, we're going to go back home inspired with a can-do attitude and keep standing for children. We will maintain our 800 number at Stand for Children, our website at Stand for Children, our continuing interaction to keep our 3,700-plus groups together to share how we are volunteering and tutoring and mentoring. We will continue to stand for children in citizens' forums throughout this year. We will stand for children through watching out and child watch visitations in many, many communities throughout the country, particularly in the 10 states which have a majority of poor white, black, and Latino children. 350 college students and their adult sponsors will go on June 2nd for 2 weeks of training, and they will be standing up for children in freedom schools in 28 sites this summer, teaching young children to read and to resolve their conflicts without violence. We will be standing up together and by the tens of thousands with congregations all over America on children's Sabbaths in October, and we will be standing up on November at the voting time to make sure that we vote for people who indeed value our children and not just with their words. And so this is not just one day, this is the beginning of the next phase of our great movement to leave no child behind. And we hope that it will give hope to the children who are going to come, many of whom have never been out of their neighborhoods along with many of their parents, and who will see that there are hundreds of thousands of Americans who believe in them, who are willing to work for them, to have them have a healthy and educated and happy future.
Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund, sponsor of tomorrow's Stand for Children rally. Democracy Now! Will be tomorrow's Stand for Children rally, and on Monday we'll bring you highlights of the event and analysis from author Holly Sklar.
little child, your eyes I see your pain. My heart cries when I hear you cry again. Frail and small, can you believe 15 years old? What is said? He hasn't gone far to go. Oh, no, no. Yes, we'll cry, yes, we'll cry. Our hearts, they feel no hate.
Desiree on the special edition of Democracy Now! Focusing on children's issues.
I suppose people don't care anymore. Or maybe people feel elections have no effect on them. I admit, if I were old enough to vote, at times I might feel the same. But then again, maybe the only reason people don't vote is because they don't know all the facts.
Youth radio commentator Aaron Asmore of California.
In the recent primary, only about 30% of all eligible voters actually went to the polls. The rest of the people stayed home. Non-voters may not realize that they are letting the small population of people who do vote decide every American's political destiny. Since I'm only 17 years old and not able to vote, I feel let down by those of us who do have that right and don't use it. People can't be expected to care about every single election issue, but they should stay informed in order to represent not only themselves, but also those of us who can't vote. Some people might say that their one vote isn't all that important, but if 50,000 other people with that same attitude decided to go out and vote, I guarantee that their actions would make a very big difference. Before the Civil Rights Movement, black people were actively kept from voting through threats and physical violence. Now that we have won that right and share it with other citizens of this country, we must use it to the best of our abilities. even if the outcomes are not as satisfactory as we would like them to be. Whether we are voting for the best of the best, or even the lesser of the two evils, we must vote if we want to make a difference. The fact that we try is all that matters. Eventually, we will see a change. With The Perspective, I'm Aaron Asmore.
Aaron Asmore is a commentator for Youth Radio in Berkeley, California. Next up, 15-year-old Wendy Diaz tells her story working for a U.S. corporation in Honduras. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. While thousands gather at the Lincoln Memorial to stand for children, one issue that's sure not to receive much attention is the impact of the global economy on children here and in the developing world. Pacifica discovered that some of the T-shirts for the Stand for Children event were assembled in El Salvador by The Limited, one of CDF's major funders. We tried to find out under what kind of conditions and if child labor was used, but couldn't get answers by Showtime today. By the way, the Children's Defense Fund is offering Stand for Children T-shirts in adult sizes only. Maybe that was just a little oversight. Television host Kathy Lee Gifford has come under fire in recent weeks when Charlie Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee revealed that clothing being produced under her name for Walmart was being manufactured in Honduran sweatshops by child labor. Kathy Lee has denied the accusation, even going so far as to cry on TV. But this week, Kernaghan brought Wendy Diaz to Washington. Diaz, a Honduran girl who's now 15, began working at Global Fashions when she was 13. Global Fashions is a Korean-owned plant that produces clothing for U.S. companies. Her story is a perfect example of how globalization of the economy affects children in poor nations. Her story is translated by Barbara Briggs.
Mi nombre es Wendy Diaz. Soy de Honduras. Tengo 15 años de edad. Entré a trabajar en la empresa Global Fashion de 13 años. El año pasado, hasta diciembre, trabajé con los pantalones de Katy Lee. En Global Fashion hay muchas menores de edad, igual que yo, de 13, 14, 15 años de edad, incluso hasta de 12 años, trabajando en los pantalones de Katy Lee.
My name is Wendy Diaz. I'm from Honduras. I'm 15 years old, and I entered into Global Fashion to work when I was 13. And last year, until December, I was working on pants for Kathy Lee. In Global Fashion, there are many minors working, like me, who are 13, 14, 15 years old, and even 12-year-olds. And they're working on the pants for Kathy Lee. There, they make us work until 7 or 9 at night. And we work on Saturdays until 12 or until 5 in the afternoon. Sometimes they keep us working all night until 6:30 in the morning. And this happened frequently with the Kathy Lee pants. And the workers in packing almost always work these shifts. Working those hours, I earn 240 lempiras a week, which they've told me is $21.86 a week. My wage was $3.34. Which is 31 U.S. cents an hour. Nobody can survive on that wage. The treatment in Global Fashion is very bad, and the Koreans insult us and demand that we work very fast. Sometimes they throw the clothing in our face, they push us, and they hurt us a lot. With the Kathy Lee pants, we had a production goal of 800 pairs of pants a day, and they demanded that we complete that production goal, and if we were able to complete it, then they'd increase the goal the next day by 50 more pairs of pants. In Global Fashion, the plant, it's very hot, it's almost like an oven. They don't let us go to the bathroom. They keep it locked all day. And we can only go twice a day. And they don't allow us to talk. And if they find us talking, then they give us an 8-day suspension with no wage. And they even maltreat the pregnant women a lot. They send them to the packing department and they give them the job of pressing. There, they have to work 12 or 13 hours a day on their feet. And their feet swell up, and that's what they do to make these workers quit. And then the company doesn't pay their complete wages or their severance pay. And the Koreans like to touch the young girls. They like to touch us a lot, maybe as if they're playing, they touch our legs or our buttocks. Many of us would like to go to night school, but we can't. And we don't have medical insurance, and we also have to pay for medicines. North Americans from companies from the U.S. have come to visit Global Fashions many times, but they've never talked with any worker. All of us workers at Global Fashion are very young. The majority of us are young women, 13 up to 23 years old. And I suppose that the Koreans don't hire older people because they would not accept all the abuses. And the majority of us are afraid. The time that we met with Barbara and Charlie, afterward the company threatened us. And they said that they might fire all of us. Also, the manager called a meeting of all the workers inside the plant and said that he wasn't going to accept any union in the plant. And if somebody tried to organize, that he was going to fire them immediately. The company hires spies so to inform them of everything that we do when we're trying to organize. When we had a group of 40 of us who wanted to organize, the company found out and they began to fire our compañeros. And they harassed others so that we had to quit when we couldn't bear it anymore. More than 50 workers were fired because we wanted to organize. When we leave work at 9 o'clock at night, it's very dangerous and we have to go out in groups and we go to our houses almost running because there's a lot of crime and there's no transport. I'm an orphan and I live with an aunt and we live in a small house where there are 11 of us and I have to work to help my brothers. Right now, we're in production. We're producing Eddie Bauer and J. Crew. And there are still a lot of miners working in the factory. We want to work because really we need to, but we also want them to give us permission so we can attend night school. Really, I'd like to talk with Kathy Lee to ask her to help us to put an end to all this maltreatment so that they'd stop screaming at us and hitting us and that they'd allow us to go to night school and to organize to defend our rights. And we want Kathy Lee to return her work to the factory, but with better conditions and a just wage.
15-year-old Wendy Diaz speaking at a press conference on Capitol Hill this week.
My name's David Dyson. I'm a Presbyterian minister from Brooklyn, New York, and involved in the People of Faith Network. The other night on television, this picture was shown to Miss Gifford as a picture of some of the young women who work on her clothing. And she dismissed it by saying this could be a picture of anybody. We know now that it's not just a picture of anybody. This is Wendy Diaz in the middle of some of her fellow workers. Prior to this, Ms. Gifford dismissed those in the human rights community working on these issues as nobodies. And I'd just like to say that Wendy Diaz is not just anybody. She's not just a nobody, she's a somebody. She's a child of God who has just as much right to a decent life and decent working conditions as Miss Gifford's children have. What may be apparent to you is the danger that Wendy is in after she comes to the United States, makes these appearances, and returns home. She may never work again in the garment industry. She may never work again, period, due to a very sophisticated system of blacklisting in those countries. The People of Faith Network, which is a group of religious congregations in the United States which are becoming increasingly active on issues of economic justice, are going to be working together with the National Labor Committee to try to put together some kind of a scholarship fund for Wendy, so that when she goes back, she has the opportunity to go to school, just like my daughter did when she was 15 years old. Also, I think it's important to say that it's not enough for companies like Walmart to just keep cutting and running from situation to situation until we can catch up with them and expose another situation. Companies like Walmart need to go back to Honduras and clean up those plants where they subcontract and demand that those companies live up to even their own corporate codes and the laws in those countries. So speaking as a member of the religious community, I'm confident that the religious community in this country is going to become more and more active in this campaign. Nobody wants to go into their kids' closets and see clothes that are made by other kids and under these conditions. Thank you.
David Dyson, Presbyterian minister with the People of Faith Network here in New York. This week's press conference was held by California Democrat George Miller, who's pushing his colleagues in Congress to act to stop the exploitation of child labor.
The story that that we have heard here this morning is one that has unfortunately been told by young children around the world, and all too often implicating American manufacturers, designers, contractors, and celebrities. But the time has come so that parents will have a right to know that the toys and the garments that they buy their children were not made by other exploited children, and that men and women who buy designer clothes or other clothing will know that the manufacturer is not hiding behind the good name of some celebrity like Kathy Lee Gifford or others in making those clothes with exploited labor and child labor. The fact is that despite laws against the use of child labor and laws protecting the minimum wage, labor exploitation is rampant, both domestically and abroad. We have a situation where celebrities hide behind retailers, retailers hide behind contractors, and contractors hide behind subcontractors. Apparently, nobody is responsible for the exploitation of children, for the exploitation of women and others in the workforce. And yet, somehow, this exploitation continues to take place. The fact is that this is a problem that must be solved at the top. This is a problem that celebrities who loan their names, retailers who invest hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising, and contractors who work for those retailers must put an end to the process of the exploitation of children and the exploitation of others in the workforce. In an economy of consumer products, where we know if tuna is dolphin safe, we know if pajamas are flame retardant, we know if an automobile gets so many miles per gallon, we know if a commodity is made of cotton or synthetic, somehow we are unable to tell the American consumer whether or not it is free of child labor, of child exploitation, of child abuse, and the abuse of others in the workplace. This can no longer continue. And what I am asking is today is that the U.S. companies will voluntarily adopt a simple label on products sold in the United States. That label is No Sweat. That is a label that will represent to the American consumers, with the backing of the manufacturer, the backing of the retailer, that this product with this label sewn into it or put on it was not made with child labor or exploited labor. It's a very straightforward representation, but apparently a very difficult representation to get from manufacturers and retailers today. They all tell us that they have agreements with their contractors, with their subcontractors, not to use child labor, not to use exploited labor, but then they quickly tell you that they have no ability to police those agreements, they don't know everything that is going on, and that leads us back to Wendy Diaz, because that leads us back to a situation, depending upon what plant, in what country, under what conditions, is sewing a particular batch of clothing, assembling a particular toy, or assembling a particular line of clothing, you may or may not be buying a product that is used child labor in the manufacture. These companies that are so rich, these companies that have done so well in the American marketplace, owe it to the American consumer. They owe it to the American consumer to once and for all declare that their clothes have no sweat, no sweat of children and no sweat of exploited workers. If these companies fail to do this, if they fail to take the voluntary action that they can control, and mind you, we're talking about companies, we're talking about celebrities that are monsters in this field. They dictate the outcome. Michael Jordan, Kathy Lee Gifford, Walmart, Kmart, Federated Stores, The Gap, Levi Strauss, some of these companies have taken that step. But when they set the standards will be adhered to. And we think what we have seen evolve here is that people who are unintentionally caught up in this, because representations are made to them, people who did not know about it but no longer can claim that, and what we're saying is that this voluntary action should be taken place. If that's not the case, then I think the Congress is going to have to step in, because the American marketplace cannot be used as an outlet center for exploited child labor and exploited labor generally. Then we have to look to legislation offered by my friend Congressman Moran that deals with the banning of importation of goods, which deals with the question of concessionary loans and foreign assistance to companies that continue to allow children to be exploited. Congressman Moran and Congressman Frank have dealt with this kind of legislation. And finally, the label has to carry with it the representation and the assurance to the American public that independent, random, unannounced inspections are made, because no longer can the manufacturers and retailers continue to hide behind the lame excuse that somehow they didn't know what that particular subcontractor was doing on that particular day. If we do that, we have the opportunity to free these children, such as Wendy Diaz, to go to school, to pursue an education, to pursue a childhood with the understanding that they will be protected in the workplace, they will be protected in the marketplace. This is not something that the manufacturers and the retailers can avoid.
Congressman George Miller, Democrat of California.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield and Pat Egan. Thanks to Ellen O'Leary and the folks at Youth Radio in Berkeley. Our engineer is Matthew Finch, our director, Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Grayson Challenger, Paul Wunder, Samori Marksman, Valerie Van Isler, and the whole crew at Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York, where we've been broadcasting for the last 2 weeks. Monday, we'll be back in Washington bringing you highlights of the Stand for Children rally. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
But you cannot make them just like you.